This is Holland Hall. It is October 4th, 2018. I am joined by
Maria Mask,
Elizabeth Rose Brooks,
and Viviana.
All right, great. So today we're here to talk about the intersecting identities and your experience here at the University of Florida as a queer Latina.
Mm-hmm.
So before we begin, as you did before we started, do you mind stating your pronouns and if you do identify as far as sexual orientation or gender identity, to share that with us?
I will say she, hers, and my sexual identity, my gender identity has been very fluid over the years, going back and forth.
Okay.
So I, at this point, it's like whatever I am right now.
Got you. And do you identify any way as far as sexual orientation is concerned?
In terms of sexual orientation, I label myself as queer, even though for many, many years I was a lesbian separatist and then a lesbian, and then I finally dropped all of those and decided to embrace the umbrella.
Great.
Yeah.
So just real quick, could you give us a little bit of background as far as, you mentioned last night in the panel both where you were born,
mm-hmm.
And then eventually you moved here from Venezuela to join the University of Florida.
Mm-hmm.
Could you just kind of go over that
very
briefly?
Fast?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, actually, I was born in Cuba. I came to the United States the first time as a refugee in 1961, and then my parents moved to Venezuela, and I moved with them, of course. I was 5 years old. Or no, at that time I was seven, I'm sorry. Because we spent like 2 years in here. And then I came back as a student when I was 25. So much of my education from elementary, middle, and high school was in Venezuela. And then I came here to study, all the way to master's degree.
So in terms of like your queer identity and how that developed and how you perhaps came out to yourself and then came out to family, can you kind of pinpoint a time in your life?
It's very difficult. Because I think I'm one of those people that was born queer. Well, I don't know that anybody's not, but anyway. By the time I was maybe 3.5, 4, I had 18 male cousins. I was the only woman in that generation. And I rejected every single, in Cuba, all of the girls had little, and I would just, no. No, 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 no. And I dressed like all of my cousins, and I went up the trees, and I had my hair cut like my father until the time that I was probably, that I developed breasts, pretty much. And then I also went to woman-only school all my life, where you had to wear a uniform, and you had to have certain canons of length of hair and whatnot. So, if you see all the photos from like, 4 to 12, I was a boy.
Mm-hmm.
And people always said, call me a boy.
Mm-hmm.
And my mother and my father never corrected it because it was like, it's too much explanation. We're tired of this,
mm-hmm.
whatever. You know, so there was not an issue with me having a different gender.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when I came out as a lesbian, that was a major fuss.
Mm-hmm.
Because in the Latino community, you're supposed to be a mom and married a man. And I was talking about marrying another girl when I was 7. And that was already the beginning of it.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, because I went to woman-only school, I had the whole plethora of, choices. Nuns, school mates and all of those kinds of things. So I keep insisting on it. And my mother would just go with the spoon out from the kitchen. No, that's not going to be happening, in Spanish. So it's very hard to pinpoint a time because I don't come out. I didn't feel the need to come out. I was who I was. And never was told that I could not express my gender identity.
Mm-hmm.
But then when my sexual orientation, that was a major ordeal for my parents, and I'm the only woman in the family, only child. And so suddenly I became a woman. And then the treatment, I was my father's best friend. We would go fishing, we would go to the barber together, we would do all these things. And suddenly he would say, no, don't help me with the car. Woman, don't do those things. And I'm like, I've been doing that thing all the time. What do you mean that woman don't do those things? So, my consciousness of feminism came in very early because of that shift.
Mm-hmm.
Because I didn't fit in any of the categories that people wanted to put me. And there was that gray area with my parents in between gender and sexual identity. And so which one was permissible but the other not.
Mm-hmm.
That was too much.
Well, do you think that they expected you to kind of grow out of?
Yeah. And my mother wanted to have, like any Latina mom, wanted to have grandkids. And so my mother died in 2012. My mother died, so not that long ago. And when I cleaned up her apartment, she still had a bag full of baby clothing for my children. And I was already almost 50-some, you know, my mid-50s. Mm-hmm. But she never gave up the idea that she was going to have, you know, grandkids. Mm-hmm. For me, because there's nobody else in the family. So yeah, and for my father, he was okay with my transitioning, and he was more accepting. Mm-hmm. And he would do it in ways that were odd. Like, he would give me tie, and I didn't wear ties. Mm-hmm. That was not my thing. He would give me ties for my birthday, or boxer, silk boxer shorts, and I didn't care for either one. Mm-hmm. But anyway, it was his, he was very confusing, didn't know what to do. So he tried to, at least he thought that was what I would want.
Yeah.
But my mother was, no, you know. And it would be immediately, we'd get in the same room, and we both are very strong women, because there's no woman in my family that is not strong, period. And the moment we get together, it will be butting heads, and she will be making homophobic remarks and making jokes and talking about it in the third person as if I was not in the room. And so I kind of decided I'm not going to leave home anymore, so goodbye. You know. And so that was pretty much a big major transition. But I think that I have made myself and find, I have found my own space in my own self, wherever I go. So coming out in the terms of coming out, like saying I'm a lesbian, or, you know, those kinds of things that you verbalize, happens when I moved here. First of all, Latin America in the 1970s, you could get killed for saying that. So even gay and lesbian couples were married and make believe that they were living together, but they had, the male had the lovers and the woman had their lovers, and they lived together and got married because of to avoid problems. And so coming here, actually, I became a radical feminist, and I already was a radical feminist in Venezuela and an activist and working for women's rights, but here I added the dimension. So I would say that an unofficial date much earlier, but an official date of embracing the category of lesbian, 1980, pretty much.
When you came here to Gainesville?
Yeah. And then, like every one of us who came out of, one of the reasons you leave the country is you can't live there, mm-hmm. if you want to be yourself. And so you move away. And then my parents wanted me to come back, and I'm like, I might die of starvation, I might deal with immigration, I do whatever, I'm not going back there, you know. So that was the, I stayed here. I live in Gainesville for about 18 years. There's an incredibly radical community of really strong lesbians here, and I met them all, and I live in the house of Corky Culver, who was one of the, you know, woman matriarchs in the area. And so I was a house mate with her. So I got to meet the entire community, and I was in all kinds of organizations and founding all kinds of organizations to work outside of campus. And then on campus at the time that I was here, it was not, I didn't find my friends here. I found them out in the community. So, or my, you know, other gay and lesbians, because people were really, you know, closeted. They're not, at least the Latino community. And most of the people of color community, mm-hmm. too, they were pretty closeted, or I didn't know where they were. Mm-hmm. So when I found the lesbian community, mm-hmm. and that was not happening since 1980 until 1994, so it's like about 10, almost a decade, until I found that. And it was kind of like an event that I attended, and I had no idea. And then I went like, oh my God, there are, all of them are here, you know. And that was the immediate, you know, connection. And then from there, I started working with different radical groups and attending the March on Washington and all of those kinds of things.
Can you remember what event that was?
Yes, it was actually a weekend event. I don't know if you ever heard of Flash Silvermoon. She passed away last year, but she is a radical lesbian musician that have been one of the biggest activists in Florida for years and years. And she happens to be also the psychic of Florida at that time, and did a lot of astrology readings and whatnot. And so she had organized, I'm going to back up a little bit. I met a woman from the same area that I lived in Venezuela, and her name was also Maria, which we call each other Tocayas, which is woman with the same name, or person with the same name. And so she told me, immediately we clicked, and I knew she was like, oh, you look like a dyke. And we started talking, and yeah, we recognized each other. And so she lived in a sister city. We never met in Venezuela. Maracay and Valencia are really close. Yeah. It's like Melrose in here, pretty much. And so I said to her, ¿Dónde están las mujeres? You know, where are the women? And so she said, there's something going on this weekend, and you need to meet Flash Silverman. And I'm like, who the hell is Flash Silverman? What kind of name is that? And so she tells me, like, oh, you have to meet her. You have to meet her. And so we're talking, and we go to a little store on University Avenue. And I'm trying to remember. I think it was Malia's Import, Malia's business, which was Esugu Imports. And Malia was one of those alternative business owners back in the 1990s that was already into the fair trade and will go and support communities in Central America and bring textiles and those kinds of things. But she also have, like, you know, different kinds of things like notebooks and whatnot. So I'm there, and I am never been a person attracted to shiny colors. It's not my thing. The rainbow kind of shiny, to wear them. I love the rainbow, but I don't want to wear those colors. Mm-hmm. And there's this little journal with all of those rainbow colors, very flashy. And I don't know, some energy had me picked it up. And I went like, what? I need to buy this. I didn't know why. And so Maria is with me, and she's telling me, you need to meet Flash. And bling, the ring, you know, the bell and the door sounds. And I turn around, and there's this, like, goddess, 300-pound, beautiful woman with all of the things hanging, a tie-dye shirt with all of the rainbow colors. And she goes like, oh, what a beautiful notebook. I could write on that. And I'm like, okay, I bought it and give it to her. And she said, by the way, we're going to have this reunion of all the weekend women, lesbians, activists, whatnot, and it's going to be a spirituality circle in Canapaja Gardens. Wow. And so she tells me, I need a coordinator for the day. I'm going to appoint you coordinator. And that was like, okay, me? I mean, what are you talking about? And then I went like, yeah, I plan events all the time. So yeah, okay. So I work as coordinator of that event. And it was Canapaja Gardens, this big, you know, the open area that is facing the lakes. Mm-hmm. There was about 200 women in this big circle. And we had the corners with the Yoruba family, which my abuela in Cuba was Yoruba, yeah. Santeria. And the four corners were called by different than Bahira Sugarman, who was a woman in the Jewish community that has been in that group for many years, was also there. She's not gay, but there were a couple of straight women as well. It was women, but primarily lesbians and dykes. And in those days, those were the levels that we had. There was another corner called by a Native American woman that I don't remember her name right now. And the other one was, I don't remember now, Flash, you know, she always would call the South Corner Fire. That was her thing. So anyway, make a long story very short. There was they have been rehearsing. A lot of these women are musicians, drummers. So there was like, I don't know, 10, 15 drummers in there. It was such a powerful, windy night. It was like the big fire in the middle. I mean, I think it was like an initiation for me. Like when you talk about initiation in the Egyptian tradition or something like that, like a major ritual that you go through. And women were dressed like goddesses, you know, Amaterasu, somebody that was Japanese, and, you know, Astarte and Yemaya, and, you know, everybody from all over the world. And they all did their dances and this stuff. And I'm like, my jaw was going to fall off. And I'm like, where have I been all my life, you know? So anyway, so from that moment on, I was a radical. Nobody can stop anything. Once you gain certain awareness of things, and it was all in one shot, you know, you can go back. And so I joined, and actually I was one of the founder members of Radical Feminists and Lesbians for Diversity. In 1992, 2 years after the murders of Rawlings and the serial murders and all that, we had a research of neo-Nazis in the area. So I became, my focus was protesting and going to all of the rallies of the Ku Klux Klan. And I was dangerous. I almost got killed on that little nonsense. But it was a group of all radical lesbian feminists and for diversity that we organized, and we kind of follow all of these groups with our signs, you know, peace, equality, and organize the counter protest. And it was pretty scary time. Not different than now, having Spencer on campus and having those things. I'm sure that if you go now, Melrose, Palatka, Lottie, Stark, those towns, those were all of those people lived in the past, and I'm sure they're new generations that were trained in the same way are again resurging right now. So that's it was a very political. It never was just about my sexuality. It was about women rights, sexuality. And I came from a country where women rights were really very important. And during the time that I was young, a lot of reform of the code, the civil code. We don't have a law by precedent, but we have the Roman code. Everything had been rewritten and to incorporate the rights of women. All kinds of rights, even rights for domestic employees, which was, you could not call maids, you know, that was incorrect. And then they had, if you had a domestic employee that cleaned your house, you had to pay them vacation, you have to pay them, you know, benefits. And if they were allowed to pregnancy leave, and they, like if they were any other worker. So there were all those kinds of protections put into law. So I've been a radical feminist. So I went from being a radical feminist in Latin America to coming here and being a radical lesbian feminist. So it was not a, it was a, like a natural transition, I guess.
So you mentioned the storefront, or the store. Was there any other spaces here in town?
All of the spaces that I have memory, well, the University Club, of course, it was the place. And I was a big dancer. So Spectrum was the place where everybody would do poppers and I don't know, whatever. And we danced like crazy. And then whatever was fashionable in the day. Then there was Metro for a while. That was a little bit more techno. And then University Club was all the way there. And there was a lesbian that I think the Melody Clubs could, I think it's still there. And I don't know. It may be. It was a tiny little place in the obscurity of the, I don't even know now where it was, because I was always in my way to it and the way out. It was like a nebula, you know. So anyway, Skeeters, which was a place where we all went to have breakfast at 3 and 4 o'clock in the morning after going dancing, which they were really right wing, but they kind of had to learn to live with us. But to have a, I don't believe there was a specific place. It wasn't our houses. Like different gay men and different women, we had also the human rights campaign that would just, we would get together, all of us working, and everybody who came, and we do a lot of like lesbian potlucks. And the community here, the woman community, was very organized. Much more than the men. And in those days, there was not the language that we have today. There was no recognition about, you know, transgender and all those kind of things. I would say that the lesbian community was for lesbians. And we didn't really have those discussions back then. And there were butch women and femme women. They're still the roles of the 1950s or whatnot. And I was kind of a little annoyed with that, because they will give you labels. And like, I was a five butch because I didn't have hair. And I'm like, I'm not even, what are you talking about? I'm Maria or Marielle, which is my name that I go by, you know, friends. So why are you trying to define me? Let me tell you what I am. But anyway, it was a time of a lot of the La Casita. Once I became director, and IBC became centers where the Latino, the LGBT, Latino, African American, Asian, any of the cultures will gather And we had an advisor at the University of Florida, Anna Robles Rhodes, who was a multicultural advisor at that time. And she did an excellent job with the LGBT community, with the Native American community, with the Asian community, with the Hispanic community. She dealt with all of the groups and incorporating everybody and creating spaces for us. So, but there was not, I mean, there was a LGBT group in part of student government and an organization, but within that organization there was the people of color LGBT group, because they didn't feel they fit the needs of the other group, and so they began to, there were Latinos and African American and different group, different people, they relocated to La Casita because they felt at home there. And then for me, it was like, why do I want to go to Race Union? I have everything here, so let's do it here. You know. So it was, and in the lesbian community I mentioned, they were very organized. And there was a newsletter, Mama Raga, and I believe it's still around today. And in that newsletter, all of the, you know, events, calendar, and not only events in the town, but like Michigan and whatever was going on, and you know, all of the festival, the Woman Festival, and then letters from women talking about issues, or and people would respond, and then contact dykes. If you go to Washington D.C., you can stay in my house. So it was a big community, and there were a lot of writers and poets and actors, and so we were doing a lot of acting, and the Repertoire Theater was a big place of community too. They were very supportive for a very low fee, and so there were all kinds of like playwrights and all kinds of things going on, and everyone had like their little niche, but I don't think there was I don't know about it, a center where everybody got together. We just did a lot of things to go together, like Pride, where we all organized, and the Pride committee was, you know, very mixed. There was a lot of racism within the community, and so for us Latinos and Latinas, we needed to have that conversation of our privilege, the ones that are white, the, you know, how do we heal from racism so that we can really work together. And it was a lot of conversation, and we did a lot of consciousness raising. And I took off a year before I did La Casita. I took off a year, and I went cross-country, and I stayed in lesbian homes everywhere, people who know people for free. And I was interviewing women who grew up in inner-city ghettos who were lesbians. And I don't know, I just said, I need a break from everything. I don't want any structure. So I lived on the road for about a year. And when I came back, I started like more officially being committed to just hold a position where I could do more work for all of my communities and all of the communities and period and unifying. So I kind of learned from all of the fishbowl types of, you know, consciousness raising that were happening in Ohio and California and different places, and came back, and then I got that spot at La Casita, that post, and we started working together. Katrina was the new director for the Institute of Black Cultures. She was energetic and an attorney, and we had, you know, the same vibe of wanting to unify the two places and create bridges. So we did programming that included both, and the Institute of Healing Racism kind of emerged from those efforts, but a lot of consciousness raising during the consciousness raising actually began before I even had the post, but we were using the churches in La Casita and not La Casita was not there, IBC, in different places to do the meetings. And it was all about, you know, men listen and women speak up, or, you know, these different groups talk and everybody whites listens, you know, and those kinds of things. And then after those people talked and talk about their personal experiences, they will leave. That was a format. And then the rest of the people had to absorb that and engage in dialogue instead of and it was moderated so that no one would just get, I can't believe so-and-so said that. It's their personal experience. You can, you know, there's no, you can say, you can deny somebody their personal experience. So there was a lot of going on with the community at that time. And I think I was doing more activism for civil rights and for the LGBTQ, 2S, what all of them are now. We didn't have all of those names back then. And so by the time I got into La Casita, I already have this really clear that the LGBT people of color wanted to do something. And so they were included in the Florida Collegiate Forum, whatever it is that you want to develop for that. There were, you know, workshops. AIDS was a big thing back then, and we had a lot of cases in Alachua County with even people that we knew. And so there were training on, there was AIDS education, there was all kinds of things going on. And then also, you know, whatever program you want to develop will help you get the funding and will help you do it. So that the Institute was another, you know, place where there was a room for LGBT students, at least during the time that I was there. And that was something that was claimed by the students. They came and asked for it, like the second day I was there. And it, I got into a lot of trouble for it because I publicly addressed People Awareness Week invited by the LGBT community to speak as a Latina lesbian. You're a token for the Latino community, for the lesbian community, for every community that you represent. And so I was there and very happy to do so. And of course, the alligator quoted like a little piece of quote. And the next day I have the president or vice president, I don't remember now, of the Hispanic faculty storming to my, this is a disgrace, you know. And I just let him go on and on and on. And then, you know, Iris brought coffee and he just forgot about it and left. But it was constant, you know, people that, or either they wanted to make you, put that part of you in a corner, because everybody recognized that I was doing a great job. I never had a problem with that. And everybody was supportive because I'm a networker. So I find the way of how to connect with people. And then once you enter here, there's, you know, little that they can do to, you know, to cut you off. And I'm Latina and charming and hugs and this and that and the other. And I use it when I need to, you know, which is, I mean, it's natural. But if I have to use it purposely, I will be more emphatic about it. So you have your ways around those things. So I didn't have a, you fight the administration, but my thing was not fighting. My thing was like, if the students want to do something and I want to do something that I hear that is going to be problematic, because they really don't understand. It's ignorance, what we're dealing with. And I'm not going to change ignorance because it doesn't change. You go and do it. You don't tell anybody. And then if somebody comes up with something, you go, hi, but how come is that? Well, I didn't know, you know. That's it. That's what my father taught me to do, and he was a union organizer in Venezuela. And so you just do it behind the scene, tranquilo, and then you advertise, and you know, in those days we didn't have media, social media and all that, so it was advertised word of mouth and whatever, and so things would happen. And because I always kept that, you know, diplomacy and that kind of approach to the administration, I knew exactly what they were doing, and I would research everything down to the T of what's going on. So I knew I knew the personality. So you kind of understand how people are and you work with them instead of against them. And I gained respect. And then I was very lucky during that time, because at the time that I was at the Institute as director, I got the honor and privilege of meeting Phyllis Mick, who was the first Dean of Women at the university. Back in the days when the university did not allow women to wear skirts, she had been here that long, and she was the first dean, you know, of women, and then dean of student services. And she and Irene, who were both gay, they created they were the founders of the Committee Against Sexism and Homophobia. So I immediately, I know those are two powerful women. One was the head of judicial with student services, and the other one was under the dean of student services, but she really had more power than him. She just had been there so long that she was more interested in teaching and dealing with diversity issues and all that. So I lecture a lot in her classes, and we did a lot of workshops together. And having those two powerful women kind of like on each arm, when something didn't work, I go like, Phyllis, this is going on. What? Oh, no. We need to resolve that, you know. So it was, I found the way of making the alliances, and I was lucky that those people were there at that time. And it was very easy for me to make those alliances because I was part of student services. So they were there, and we have to attend meetings together all the time, staff meeting and those kinds of things. So even though there was a dean of student services, I don't think I exchanged many conversations with him throughout the whole time that I was there. For 2 years, it was with Irene and with Phyllis that we kind of plotted together a lot of the things. And then, you know, participating in Susan B. Anthony. We even have now meet at La Casita because it was a safe place for women. All right. So it was creating community, which is what I like to do.
I don't want to monopolize the question asking, so I want to open it up.
Yeah, so I think I'm really interested to hear. So you said that La Casita was kind of a hub for the LGBTQ students as well after it was built. I'm interested in the types of conversations and dialogues that they were having and the types of issues that they were facing at that time.
Mm-hmm. And I can speak for myself. At that time, I was not a student. I already had my master's degree and had graduated. And I'm not going to say that it was a hub because the group that was not that big, okay? But they felt safe there. And I remember there's a member of the community that is still here, and he's now a nurse at Chance Hospital. And he was one of the persons that formed that committee of people of color within the LGBT group. I think it will be worthwhile interviewing him. Yohandres Suarez, and you might want to, I don't know if you might want to blur that name. I don't feel comfortable outing people. I don't know what his situation. I think he's flamboyantly out. At least he was back then, but you can never assume people have jobs and changes in life and whatnot. And he lives back in Gainesville now. He and Amara, who's not here anymore. I don't remember all of the names. But they will come and do meetings and also plan activities. As an administrator, there was so many groups. We had like 16 student groups under the umbrella of the Hispanic Association. Mm-hmm. And then we also have students running for student government. And there was so much going on that I would just go in and out. But I actually allowed them to do the programming and just connect them in those kinds of things. So as sort of the conversations, I drop in and out, or they would come and sit in my office. There was a couch in front. It was kind of like a counseling place. And so you would see them just hanging in there and going like, Maya, But, you know, it was so much going on during that time that it was like, and not only that, but I was like, we were saying yesterday, you're the token for anything happens. So I'm in all of these committees, the Committee for Affirmative Action, this, that, and the other. So IFAS, the School of Medicine, every single thing going on, they need the token Latina, every single conference, the men's conference, the women's conference, everybody needs you in there. So I was like a Pac-Man going from one thing to another, waka, 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 talking everywhere. And there were times that it was like, I don't want to talk to anybody. ISIS, close all the doors. I don't even want to have the window open. You know, I mean, close the blinds and I'm going to just do work because in order to write the letters and get the funding, you needed time in the office and that was spares. But in terms of programming, and I can send you all of that. I have copies of all of the different Latino collegiate forums,
yeah.
And they list and describe all of the activities that were programmed, including the LGBT.
We would love that.
So yeah, and you could have that as archive. And I made copies of everything when I left because I thought they're going to disappear this.
Right.
And they have done that, you know, over and over again. And so I don't have originals, but I do. And I have pamphlets of all of the programs, you know. So I can send you. I told Ryan that I was going to send the whole package to him, because I'm 60, so I doubt that I can hold to it too long, and somebody's gonna trash it at some point, you know. So so you will see the kinds of programs and the kinds of conversation. And there was a resistance from other Latino students. Mm-hmm. Why do they have to be a part of the Hispanic Latino Collegiate for? Because they're Hispanic Latino. And it's a Hispanic Latino, and in those days, Latino Latina was not, and then that was another fight. Why do we have to call it Hispanic Latino Latina? Because, well, I don't want to just, you know, why not an A in parentheses? I don't want to be a parenthesis. All of those conversations it was a constant conversation about one thing or the other. So whether it was, you know, and we were not even dealing with the issues of, we were dealing with intersectionality, but we didn't have the language for that. Just like during that time, I took all the students to Ethnic Crossroads, a conference, and Angela Davis was one of the presenters, and she was saying, when I was a Black Panther, we didn't have the word sexism, but those men, my brothers, will ask me, Angela, would you bring me some coffee? And I would say, you go get up and get your coffee yourself, you know? And that's how, I mean, so you don't, you know that you are not going to accept that, but you didn't have the language to name it at the time. So it was the same thing with gender issues and all those kinds of things. And that continues to be a struggle, I would say, especially with my contemporaries, because, you know, I think because of the lines of work that I have chosen, I am forced to continue to move and grow. But a lot of the women that I met back then, they still think the way they thought in the 60s, and that's the way they thought in the 80s, and that's the way they thought in the 90s. And still today, it's like, I don't want to be queer, I want to be cool. And it's okay, anybody can be called whatever they want. But if I ask you to call me a he or a she or whatever, you need to respect my side of it too. All right, so I've been seeing a lot of unilateral conversations in the community that it was my community, that was the community that supported me, and I have continuously moving. So I live in Tucson, Arizona, and the majority of it's very segregated because it's a big city and people live apart from each other. So to give you an example of that segregation of the city is also in the groups. So even among the Hispanic, Latinos, or whatever, the Mexicans, the Puerto Ricans, the Cubans, people really don't click. You have to either belong to one group or another. So I continue to be involved with the University of Arizona as an invited speaker or whatnot. I don't work there because it keeps me in touch with the groups that are kind of continuously growing. And the people that I hang out with are in their 20s and early 30s and are millennials. And because I find more in common with them, where I am, that I find among the retired woman community that still think about the politics of the 60s, and we are like how many years away from that? Things have changed. So one of the things that we did there that was interesting for a while, and then I went, like, I got burned out, and I said, no, I'm not doing this anymore. Several of us started a group called the Epiphanies, to take away all the labels, and then we will pick up a topic for each one of them. And it became a social that everybody would come, kind of like a potluck. And one time it would be gender, another one was labels, another one would be queer and inclusivity, intersectionality. And it was a space where everybody felt free to kind of, we had rules about, okay, we might disagree, but we're not going to scream at each other. That was the only rule. We're going to listen. So, yeah, people will listen, and we could get into a deep dialogue on the reasons why or why not, X, Y, or whatever, but it was dialogue, and there was a respect. But then there was always somebody who just got very agitated, And so, like, why, whether it was an older person or a younger person, it doesn't matter. And so it happened all over. So there was a point where we kind of went, like, it's a lot of work. We work full time. Then I do community activism. Then I'm a writer, and I'm also a private chef. So I don't have time for all of this. So goodbye. So it was like, now I would say that I write, and that's where I do my activism. Yeah. And it's a very... with myself. And then I do these kinds of events that I go and talk and see what's going on, because I need to know what's current. And I do a lot of work with the Department of Planning and Urban Design, which is my field in Arizona, University of Arizona, and regional. And then you always find that queer student that just from listening you talk about border relationships, they know the way you walk, the way you talk, the way you, you know, the conversation. They come after class and I'm like, you're one of us, aren't you? And I'm like, yeah, you know, you're family. Or they kind of, you know, they don't know how to tell it. And then immediately I start getting emails and, can you help me with this? And what do you think about that? And do you want to do this? So it's I think that people are really clear of who I am and, you know, whether you're talking about the mayor of Tucson or, you know, the board of supervisors, everybody knows. And I live in a city that is really open, that we had council members that are gay, out, gay and lesbians. We had a governor that was a gay, a lesbian, that ended up being the head of national security under Obama, Napolitano. So, I mean, so those things really help. And Tucson, I'm not sure about Phoenix and other areas, but Tucson is a very progressive community. So I feel like I'm in my element. I don't necessarily hang out with the community, but if I want to find the political ones, I know where everybody is. So it's just a matter of, yeah, let's do this or that. So, yeah, I don't know if you have any more questions.
Yeah, kind of bringing it back to the University of Florida, I'm interested in, you kind of talked about the spaces off campus that mm-hmm. the queer community had, but on campus, prior to La Salita, or even after, what were other spaces that queer students found themselves
in? Well, I don't, again, I can only speak for myself and the group, mm-hmm. and I really didn't meet here. I actually was one of the students that I just was not feeling very, never felt welcome at the University of Florida, now I enjoy it, but during my times as students, a lot of things happened that I was like, no, and it was different times. So all of my meeting spaces were either in the communities or IBC mm-hmm. or the churches, UCG. Also the Jewish Hallel. Mm-hmm. The places that were welcoming to those conversations at that time. Because you also have to understand that I wasn't a very radical group. And the folks that were meeting here, we didn't see eye to eye. There was not that political consensus of what's going on in the bigger picture. And I was very involved with everything related to hate crimes. And that was my focus at that time in getting to, you know, expand the bill and those kind of things. So those meetings happen in people's kitchen tables. It happens outside of any institution. And also in Emiliano's Cafe, okay, it was a little tiny place at that time, and one that was always very supportive. And actually, I think I mentioned Alianza Latina yesterday. That Alianza Latina, the majority of the women of that group were lesbians. Ali, Leticia, myself, the other Ali, four of us were lesbians, and then two other women that were straight. So that was a place too where we had conversations, and again was kitchen tables of each one of us. So yeah, I never found the in those days the Rice Union didn't have the things that you have now. I didn't find it was a very it's a very white campus, and being somebody who grew up in Latin America, at that time, and now I'm a Latina in the U.S. because I have been here since the 80s until now. But at that time, I was Latinoamericana, no fit at all. There was no fit at all. So you would find your groups outside. Same when I was in Santa Fe Community College. It was, you're Venezuela. you're Cuban. Let's get together. And it happened to be that many of us were queer, and the reason why we were here was because we were queer and we couldn't be in Venezuela. So it was the same, there was a common ground among those people that I knew. There were other Venezuelans and other Cubans that were not queer, but those were not the ones that I hang out with at that point. So yeah, I don't think that I felt welcome. It was enough to need to go to a class and sit down next to a skinhead with tattoo, with swastikas, that even though I'm white and I have a privilege because I do, the moment that you speak, and in those days I had even a heavier accent than I do now, and they will start calling you spec and, you know, all kinds of, you know, screaming at you when you will go out of class. So it's like, no, it was not. It was a hostile environment, and I didn't want to spend more time than I needed to. I either was in a library, which I love libraries, or in the classroom. But once those were done, I'm out of here. That was pretty much my association. Or my job in special ed, which I mentioned yesterday. So those were the places where you felt safe to hang out or welcome. Because I've never been the person that doesn't feel safe in my skin. I've done so many crazy things in my life in terms of activism, Venezuela, since very young, that I already know how to read people very well, so I know how to protect myself. And but it was an issue of not feeling welcome and not wanting to put my energy there. Because it's like, if you don't welcome me, I'm not going to try to convince you. It's not my role to educate you. Then I changed a little bit with the lesbian community, and that, let's do some consciousness raising. We need to do the education. But while I was a student, I had 3 jobs. And I didn't have money, and I had to go full time to school, so there was not that much extra time, and my little extra time I was not gonna spend it where I don't feel welcome. So,
do you have any other questions?
Just here to shadow. This is my first interview that I've
right on.
So I just wanted to listen, and your story is so wonderful. I'm so glad I got to be a part of this.
That's just a little tiny sliver of the story.
I guess you've spoken to it a little bit, and again, like, you can only share your experiences, but in terms of like students coming to you as far as needing a space for specifically queer people of color at the time, are there any memories you can relay regarding the need for that formation?
I tell you how the first group that came in, that left a very, very specific print of, we need to do something about this. It was actually Johandra and Amara, and I don't remember, I think there were a couple of other students, but those were the two, like, they storm into my office. They didn't make an appointment or anything. They storm into my office, and it was a few days before People's Awareness Week. And it was like, well, we're lesbian and gay, and they really don't count us in that LGBT thing. So what are you gonna do about us? It was just like that. What are you gonna do about us? And I'm like, hey, I'm a lesbian. Chill, sit down. You know, let's talk. Vamos a hablar. And they went like, oh, okay. So then the ideas would come up like that. Johandra became one of the student assistants of the institute. And that was ruffling people's feathers, because the other students there was homophobia, you know? And it's like, why is he here? Because he's Latino. He's as Latino as you are. And we also need to have all of the groups represented. So he's queer, and what's the problem with that? In those days, we didn't use queer, but he's gay. What is the problem with that? And so because he being there, working as a student assistant, then, you know, it was easy to feel welcome, because somebody receives you that is queer. Right? And you don't have to go through the ropes and explaining, hey, can I hang out, whatever. So they will program whatever they wanted to program, and I would just approve and it would happen. I was not in the office all the time, but, you know. So People's Awareness Week, we brought Gloria Saldúa, which was a major thing in campus because she was not only lesbian, but a radical feminist and a migrant worker and a PhD and professor of history of consciousness at the university, you know, Borderland, La Frontera, all of that. I mean, and even in those events, there were experiences. Gloria stayed and my partners, my partner was Ali at that time, and she was kind of like the recorder of all of the photos I have from the Institute. She took the photos because she would go and take photos and participate in everything. And we were, as a couple, we were really visible out there. And it was very, I mean, very known that we were a couple. I was very butch, she was very feminine. So when you have androgynous couples or butch and femme couples, is really easy to identify. If you have couples that are not like very distinct in certain ways, you can maybe pass, but no. And then she would just be hanging or giving me a kiss or whatnot, and everybody knew. So that was a big thing, that you have the director very openly being gay. So that was another thing that welcomed people in. And whether it was graduate students and older students, more our age, you know. So Yohandra was attracting the younger crowd, and we, Ali and I, were attracting, and Leticia and the other ones that I mentioned that were part of the Alianza Latina, we were bringing in the older crowd. And then we started getting alliances with Nina Menendez, who was bisexual at the, and she was a professor of Romance Languages, and she took on developing curriculum that included ethnic studies and gay and lesbian studies and all those kinds of things. That never happened because the administration, you know. So, but I don't remember every single thing, but that day when those students stormed in, it's like so memorable, you can't forget. Mm-hmm. And I remember one thing. Ellen DeGeneres came right after she had been fired from, they had canceled her program after her coming out nationally and whatnot. She came to the O'Connell Center. And Ellen DeGeneres was really depressed during that coming. And she came with her mother. And I remember she was wearing dark glasses. I don't know, she had like dark eyes, and she probably had been crying, I don't know how much, whatever. And her mother talked most of the time. The O'Connell Center area where that speech took place, I think it was the O'Connell Center, I know you can research that. That place was full, right? And that was not, bringing those people to campus kind of make it even more visible, even if it was not Latino or whatever. I mean, made it visible that, I mean, this is a celebrity out there. And I remember just looking at her and saying, I love you. You makes us, you know, visible with your comedy and your craziness. But that was the first show really that was addressing, you know, gay and lesbians, whatnot, in TV in those days. So it was representing us, whether it was totally representative of everybody. You cannot do that with one person and one character, but at least there was a talk. And then, those were things that were happening all during that time. So I think there was certain synchronicity going on, that even when the administration was saying no, it was just, I don't know, the universe was saying yes. And those of us who were in certain positions were able to kind of contribute in whichever way we could, by even being ourselves and being visible. Those kind of things. And I knew many professors and many tenure track professors and many staff members that were gay and lesbians, but you could not open them because they were afraid of losing their jobs. So you can't, you know, there was all of that.
It's interesting that you mentioned Ellen DeGeneres. I'm wondering now if there were any white students that were in the queer community that were also involved in these circles in La Casita and IPC.
You know, I need to consult Yohandra, but I'm not quite sure. I don't think so. Yeah. There was a lot of segregation back in the day, and our issues are not your issues. And why do we have to deal with your issues? These are the primary issues. That's why that people of color group formed from the other umbrella, because they didn't feel represented and their voices were not being heard. So they felt like they were against a wall. And again, I mean, there is, you know, I can tell you, in the Latino community, I experienced homophobia. And then I go to the queer community and there's racism, ethnicism, you know, whatever. So, I mean, it's all human. So we're going to have all those isms, whatever you call it. And at the beginning, in those days, when you don't have anything, you just need support for yourself. You can't really work with creating those bridges and creating those alliances until you feel, oh my God, I can breathe, you know? And I think that's what's going on with those students. They were being nourished. And then they will go out and do other programs with other groups that I didn't even know about, because I don't know every single student what's going on. But I think it would be really great to pair it with this from the same time to interview Yohandre, and Ryan has the information. Mm-hmm. He's just work as a nurse practitioner or something like that, a chance, and his schedule is really crazy. But so you can work. He lives with his partner here in town, and I believe he's really out. But I don't know. I would say so. And he actually came to the U.S. with Mariel, so he has some stories.
For sure.
Yeah, he has some amazing stories.
He sounds like a great contact.
Yeah.
I guess a final question that I have is, you said you're tapped into the millennials right now, and, mm-hmm. and as far as like the political circle and all of that. What are some of your observations that you see happening on this theme of the queer community, but then also queer people of color? Have the conversations changed that are happening, or what are some takeaways for us now?
I think the conversation have changed to be more inclusive. More inclusive of the different gender identities. That doesn't mean that we are where we need to be, mm-hmm. all right? More inclusive to people with disabilities. More inclusive to people who are white and identified as non-white. And by that, I mean that you look white, but you have a culture of color, whether you're Jewish or Latin American or light-skinned African-American or whatnot. I think what's happening is like the, in a way, even we're talking about more, a wider, we're talking about the shaded areas between black and white, which are many. And there's, you know, we're so departing from that duality of either or, mm-hmm. and then kind of embracing some continuum. And we're still not there. And not everybody's going to be at the same level. So even some young people could be thinking in the black and white. I mean, you also have to think about ageism and those mm-hmm. kind of things. There's no one formula to where individuals are at in their own internal conversation. There is more exposure to language, to different terms, to different types of reflection and things. And there's more, I don't know, opportunities for conversation in a regular, because we're hearing these things from everywhere. And we are, you know, hearing that people prefer to be, like I had somebody come for dinner 2 weeks ago, and I was gonna cook for my friend and the person visiting. And Jessica is telling me, okay, them are this and that, and she's using them. So I finally had to say, is it them one person or is it them several people? Because I need to know how many people I need to cook for. And it was a them one person. So, and then you respect that, and that's how you treat that person. But there are still clarifications. We're not yet there, you know, but it is, there is movement towards inclusivity, but then at the same time, like I was saying yesterday in that thing, I feel that some people, and that's not everybody, but some people who still have the ingrained racism and still have the ingrained, heterosexism or whatever isms they have, they're trying to define inclusivity, and they're trying to define, you know, all of these things from how I want you to define yourself, and I find that problematic. So if we're going to be inclusive, let everybody define themselves. And that's what inclusivity to me. And also let everybody accept whatever parts of themselves they want to accept. Because if they don't identify with something, it's not your role to identify them, you know. But we see that in academia a lot. And I have some students from the University of Arizona sometimes send me emails and say, like, you know, I'm really pissed about this. And I really didn't like this reaction about so-and-so. What do you think? And I'm like, well, I don't have the whole story, number one. But bottom line is nobody should be telling anybody how to define themselves, period. You know, and so if you want to be queer, you're queer. If you want to be, you know, gender flowing, if you will. And so, and I also have noticed that in the older generation, the term cis is very insulting for some. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a lack of understanding of why that terminology is necessary at some point. And if I have to be honest about my own identifying of myself, I'm done. I don't want any IDs. I'm Mariel, which is my pen name, or Maria, or, you know, and I'm very comfortable with whom I am. And nobody defines me, and I would choose to do whatever I want to do with it, whatever mood I am in that moment. And I want to respect everybody the same way that I want to be respected. And I believe that labels are also part of the construct. Mm-hmm. And that sometimes we are given the labels, and then we have to figure out how to use those labels. And then it's like, who came up with that? I'm very skeptical. Mm-hmm. And who is defining me? You know, is a man creating labels for me to have a different way of calling myself? Don't want that. I mean, I don't know. But anyway, but I do reading. I do understand the concept, and I do find the he, she problematic because those are categories. And that was discussed amply back in the 60s with Les Guerrières and the structuralist French philosopher, lesbian feminist, Wittig. So I'm in a way, I'm a Wittigian that I reject all of those categories, especially because I read that book in Spanish when I was in Latin America, and she wrote it for the French language, which is a Romance language, which use articles in feminine and masculine to define anything. And so la botella es female. If it is a machine, is you know, if it is a machine, el carro is a male. If it is a motorcycle, which is less powerful, it's a female. So you have that constant reminder of, you know, categories everywhere. And so I was like, in writing, it's very challenging not to write with pronouns. And so I had a time where I always wrote everything in she, meaning the she, her, inclusive. Because that's how men used to do it. And then I thought, like, well, that's silly because you're doing the same thing that they were doing, the patriarchy was doing. But I feel that as long as we are under patriarchal rules, no matter what we do, we're being defined by whatever the patriarchy kind of tosses in, you know. And then academia is an institution of the patriarchy to a certain extent. And in certain ways it serves, and in other terms it doesn't, you know. It's still perpetuating very white campus, very good old boys. Hard to go past that. And so I'm suspicious about everything that they approve. So it's one of those things that I think is a very personal journey. And but the important thing is to remember that whatever other people think is valid, and whatever other people determine that that's what they want to be or that's how they want to identify is valid. And just, it's about respect, and just, that's about it. But yeah, at this point of my life, I don't define myself as a lesbian, but more as queer, because I decided it is more encompassing. I don't know if I'm going to change my mind 3 years from now if another term comes in that I feel that is more appropriate. But, you know, and I have a lot of friends my age who are really annoyed with me because I don't call myself a lesbian. And I'm like, first of all, I grew up and I pretty much became a lesbian in Venezuela, and lesbian was not a term that, I mean, I'm used to hearing cachapera, maricona, you know, flora, que se yo, whatever. But lesbian was not something that I associated with. Now, through literature, I love Sappho and the island of Lesbos and all of that. I find it very evocative. So that's why I kind of aligned with the lesbian thing. But I was not here in the 60s. I came here in the 80s. So I came here pretty much when the millennials were being born. So what I have learned of this culture is more millennial than anything before. That's why I have a better rapport with people, because we're generationally, although I'm older, we grew up in the culture at the same time, with the same music, with the same, you know, discussions. So yeah, I didn't have those terms before. So I don't know.
Well, that's all my questions.
That'll be it for me. Yeah. Thank you so much. Thank you. I really appreciate
you. I hope I just give you more than you needed. But
no, I really appreciate it. We really appreciate you taking the time, just hanging out with us and having this great conversation. Muchas gracias.
De nada, muchas gracias. Yeah.